I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Well, getting a bad night's sleep feels just awful. Not only are you tossing and turning while it feels like the rest of the world slumbers, when it's time to get up, you feel foggy-headed and out of sorts. We're learning that long-term sleep problems can have serious health consequences with links to depression, obesity, memory impairments, maybe even cancer and diabetes. The CDC says that sleep deprivation is a public health crisis, with about a third of the American population not getting enough restorative shut-eye. And that has economic consequences in lowered and lost productivity. So today on Radio Times, what to do to sleep like a baby, the latest on naps, sleep disorders, technology, and more. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Sigrid Vesey is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, also a member of the Center for Sleep and Circadian Neurobiology. Sigrid Vesey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times to talk about sleep.
So great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. And also with us is Eileen Rosen. She's a professor of clinical medicine, also at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and immediate past president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Eileen Rosen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at whyy Radio Times. A number of ways to join our conversation. Let me put some really basic questions out here, and Sigrid, I probably asked them to you before, but how do you know if you're getting a good night's sleep?
A good night's sleep really means that you would wake up refreshed and really feel ready to attend to things. Perhaps the best measure of how well you're sleeping is really, can you do something that's really boring for a sustained period of time? And the important part about that is that includes driving.
Ah.
So if people are out driving and you're on a very mundane road, a highway or something, it's our biggest risk. And that's the time that you have to have this sustained attention for any little thing that could happen. But yet in one of those boring conditions, you may actually start to drift off or maybe even just daze out. So if someone can spring out of bed and feel alert and stay with that sustained attention during these mundane tasks, that could even be sitting in a meeting. If you can actually stay attentive to your world, then that's the best sign of good sleep.
And if you're nodding off, chances are
absolutely,
you're not getting the sleep
absolutely
that you need.
Right, absolutely.
I'm thinking too, Eileen Rosen, about that when you don't get enough sleep, that kind of groggy, foggy, almost like you've got a hangover. What is going on that makes us feel that way?
So you can have that that groggy, foggy hangover. That's a great term for it, actually, from several reasons. One, you can have it, like you said, when you're not getting enough sleep because you wake up, the brain is just almost still asleep, craving additional sleep amounts. But also when you had sustained periods of not getting enough sleep night after night after night, you wake up with almost a sleep hangover just from the fact that the sleep architecture, the way your sleep looks on those nights when you are making up sleep, it's getting sleep amounts or sleep types that are known to almost make you feel drunk when you wake up
really?
In the morning,
a
sleep hangover, particularly slow wave sleep. That sleep is associated. If you wake up with a lot of slow wave sleep or out of slow wave sleep, you're more likely to feel hungover.
Oh, and hungover, I mean, that's not just a layman's term. It's almost a medical
no,
term.
No, we call it sleep inertia, but it's a very nice layman's analogy of feeling hungover.
Well, Sigrid, it's so interesting to think about the brain and sleep and what happens. I mean, talk about architecture.
Yeah.
What happens when we are sleeping? What is our brain doing?
So our brain has to be considered really a whole factory of a lot of different types of workers, right? So all of the neurons and the glial cells are all doing different specific jobs. There are some neurons in very tiny little parts of the brain that are controlling sleep and are actually working harder in sleep than the rest of the brain. But in general, most of the cortex, the areas where you're using your thinking and these alerting systems, those are really awake when we're awake. And they will quiet down. Those little sleep centers will shush everyone to sleep to quiet things down. And what we're starting to realize is that quieting down serves several different purposes. It helps us clear out broken down mitochondria, broken down proteins, and sort of sweep out the garbage, if you will, from the brain, it's probably doing the same thing in the neurons as well, and cleaning out the neurons. Neurons, you have those neurons from the time you're born, for many of those neurons, until the time that you die. They have huge amounts of work to do, and they really literally need a rest. And that's what we're finding now. It's not just cleaning out the outside, but specific neurons really need that rest as well to restore axons, et cetera.
And so if you're not getting that kind of sleep, then what, they're working overtime?
They're working overtime. And what we're finding now is that you can put a time stamp on the brain, and the brain is actually aging. So if you are running this risk of shortening your sleep, you're probably doing things to the brain, increasing oxidative stress, putting a stress on the mitochondria that will actually move it, shift it more towards an aged brain. And the scary part of that is that really some of that is not going to be reversible.
Really?
Much of it will be reversible, and especially if you're just pulling an occasional all-nighter. But if you were to do something like shift work, which is 20% of our population, doing very early morning shifts or very late shifts, it is possible that in those circumstances, from what we can see in animal models, it suggests that there may be lasting injury in those individuals.
Eileen, I want to pick up on the CDC. It's not a brand new report, but they have been saying that about a third of Americans are not getting the kind of sleep that they need, and there are all sorts of consequences of that. Is there something about modern life that makes it difficult for us to get a good night's sleep?
Sure. I'm not surprised that it the number one third. I'm surprised it's actually only one third.
Really?
When you think about what's gone on in the last several decades in terms of even more than the Industrial Revolution, the idea that you can watch TV 24 hours, that we have electronics everywhere we want them, and that smartphones are and smart tablets and all of these things are taken into our bedroom. And so all of these things are stimulating, not just in the idea that you can do them when you are maybe avoiding going to sleep or trying to unwind or continue doing your work, but there's actually data that as our TVs and our computer screens and our phones have gotten actually better and more brilliant in the way the screens are, the blue light that actually comes from them is actually stimulating to our alerting system, to our clock. It's the exact wavelength that tells us in the morning to stay awake. So when you're looking at those things in the evening, thinking you're unwinding, perhaps watching TV or even reading from your phone, you're actually causing some alerting factors to your brain and inadvertently sending that signal.
Can you put something over your eyes to do something about that blue light that's coming in?
Yeah. So if you look there and you Google blue light canceling glasses or amber light bulbs, you can take them out. There's still the stimulation of doing these things that are not necessarily relaxing. But yes, you can do things to and even. On our iPhones, you can actually you can see that there's something called night shift, which the idea is supposed to dim your phone a little bit and try to take the blue light out. It's not clear that that entirely works, and there's some programs you can put on various computers and laptops to try to get at that. Huh. But even that is not enough also because our whole world is 24/7. We've become interconnected, and everyone is so busy and connected all the time.
Can you speak to us about circadian rhythms and secret? I mean, sort of how that factors in.
Factors in a big way, just because it really is your circadian rhythm that got you up this morning, Marty. It got you here.
Thank you, circadian rhythm, yes.
And it really is this combination of fulfilling the homeostatic drive, the need for sleep, and having the circadian time. People who have done, occasional night shifts will appreciate the fact that sometimes they're absolutely exhausted the night after they've worked early in the morning and maybe until lunchtime, and then they get home and suddenly at 6 o'clock in the evening they're wide awake, and that's because the circadian rhythm has kicked in. The circadian system has this pro-wakefulness. But I think to pick up on a point that Eileen had is that this circadian rhythm is so powerful and such a source of wakefulness that if you look at people across the United States who have televisions in their bedroom, those people have on average, an hour less sleep. So it really
is. It because they're up watching television, or there's just something about that light that's keeping them up?
Yeah, and we have a substantial proportion of our population also just keeps the television on all night. And a lot of that is the light, but it also can be the noise when the advertisements come on, the noise abruptly changes. That also can disturb sleep. So we truly, as Eileen says, have used an awful lot to disrupt our circadian rhythm in many ways, yeah.
I'm thinking, you said 20% of the population does shift work?
Yeah, some sort of a shift work, and that can include not only the night shift workers, but it's important to recognize that many people are coming in for these early morning shift works, like the bakers who have to be in at 5 in the morning. They're getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and what adds to this whole issue, in addition to the lights, is the extended commute. So as we move to a more developing rural areas, we have added that hour of commute, and I think there are nice studies that come out that also show whatever your commute time is, that also subtracts from your wake time. So put a television in the bedroom and have an hour-long commute, and you really are almost bound to be short sleep. I would also like to say that the other critical issue that we have with these short sleepers really are children, adolescents. It is so hard in today's world for children, teens, to be able to get that 9 hours of sleep. So high school students,
that's what they need, right?
High school students really should be getting 9 hours, at least 8 hours. But it's so hard, and it's partly because they have a circadian disruption, that's this phase delay. They'd like to stay up later and sleep later. That's a component of it, but they're also just completely overscheduled. We've done a disservice to our kids, I believe, in this overscheduling.
Well, let me turn back to you then. So we've got the problems.
Yeah.
Part of it is the world that we live in, the world that we have created for ourselves. So taking all that into effect, Eileen, then what do you suggest people do? I mean, turn the TV off at 8 o'clock at night and give yourself some time to some downtime to get into Slumberville?
Yes. So I think the first thing you have to think about is, when do you have to get up in the morning? And then you have to backtrack and figure out how much sleep do you need. So for adults, the recommendation is at least 7 and probably 8. So you really have to know yourself and figure out, do I need 8 hours of sleep? And if you do, and you have to be up at 6 in the morning for your commute or whatever, whatever you have to do in the morning, then you need to go to bed at 10 o'clock.
Right.
And then lights out at 10 o'clock, unwinding and asleep by 10 o'clock. And that assumes that you are 100% efficient, and many of us are not.
Well, I was just going to say, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm. So that requires allowing enough time to relax. So taking the TV out of the bedroom, if I have someone who's having trouble unwinding, I say no TV in the bedroom. You can, when you decide it's time to go to bed, you go and you do your bedtime routine, whatever that is, brush your teeth, all of those things, and you get into bed, maybe some quiet reading in a dimly lit room, but then lights out and no electronics in the bedroom. Leave them outside of the room, and particularly with our kids, as Sigrid was mentioning, no electronics in the bedroom. Many of them say they'll use that as their alarm clock. Buy them an old-fashioned alarm clock and let them use that.
Hold on to that only because we do need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about how to get a good night's sleep, and apparently Americans are not getting a good night's sleep, at least many of them. That's Eileen Rosen, and she's a professor of clinical medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Also with us, Sigrid Vesey, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, both authorities when it comes to sleep and how to get it and what to do about it if you can't get it. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. We are talking about sleeping in this hour of Radio Times. Eileen, you were talking about just, you know, what it, get the TV out of the room and get yourself some quiet time, maybe do some light reading, and then fall asleep. And during the break, we were talking about the fact that sometimes that's when thoughts kick in and you begin obsessing about something that might have happened at work or something you should have done or why didn't you do X, Y, or Z. What is that about?
Right. So certainly for many people, when you first get into bed is the first quiet time many of us have had during the day. So it's not unusual or unreasonable to think we might start first having all the thoughts to process things that have happened during the day or that might happen the next day. Many patients will tell me, I start thinking about all the things I have to do tomorrow. So one of the pieces of advice I give them is before they go into their bedroom, usually several hours before they're going to go to bed, take out a notebook, a piece of paper, and write things down. I call it a worry book or a worry pad. Write down all the things you either need to do or that you're worried about, or just have a brain dump of the things that happen during the day. And a lot of people find that helps them really not have to have those thoughts because they've had their quiet time beforehand. The other thing to realize that we were talking about during the break is that insomnia, having trouble sleeping because you're thinking about things, is not uncommon. And about 30 million Americans at any one time in their life will have trouble sleeping. And in most of them, about 80% of them, after about a few days, for sure by 2 weeks, it will go away. Huh. And so not stressing about it and saying, okay, this is happening to me, I'm going through something right now, and I'll be better in a few weeks, whether I do something specific about it or not, take medications, have a worry notebook, whether I do any of those things or not, as long as I stick to my usual routine, I'll be okay. There's just a few that end up, about 20%, with more chronic insomnia.
So let's talk a little bit more about insomnia, that there are different kinds of insomnia. And one of the things you said during the break is make sure we talk about alcohol.
Yeah,
let's do that one.
So alcohol also fits with this business that you can fall off to sleep right away. Alcohol is very good at shortening the sleep latency, helping you fall off to sleep. But there is also, it's a short-lived drug, and there's a rebound effect that you can wake up from alcohol for later in the night. So alcohol may help you fall asleep, but you may not be able to stay asleep. So in general, if an individual can wean off of alcohol and literally have no alcohol prior to really get a good idea of what would your sleep be, what would your quality of life be, how would you feel in the daytime? We talked a little bit about that daytime hangover feeling. It doesn't have to be a substantial amount of alcohol, and it doesn't have to feel like a hangover. There really can be this grogginess, even from a glass of wine. So it is interesting and important for people just to see where they could be without it. There are people who may be able to fall right off to sleep. You have a very busy day at work, and you've built up this homeostatic drive, so you can fall right to sleep. You will normally, across the night, wake up every 90 to 120 minutes. It's just part of a normal sleep schedule. You're supposed to wake up. Typically, it's a few minutes, and you're right back to sleep. But for the individuals who have that worry on the mind or haven't digested their thoughts earlier in the day, suddenly that becomes a time that they're awake and they're thinking, oh no, I should have paid this bill. I need to do so-and-so. I have so much to do. I should have called my mother, da-da-da-da-da. So I would agree totally with Eileen and say, have some time in your day. It could be a walk across town. It could be writing the notes in a book. But put that well away from the bedroom, because what you don't want is to have an associate to start associating the bed with concerns or worries. You want that bed to be that luscious place to plop into.
For sleep and sex, absolutely, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It's pure pleasure. It's a wonderful place to be.
If I could just add to that, the alcohol comment. So I agree with everything Sigrid said. Alcohol in and of itself really affects our sleep architecture. So individuals, many people will say, I fall asleep so much faster. What Sigrid's describing, that, you know, some people say, I get into bed and my head's asleep before I hit the pillow. Some people will say, alcohol helps me do that, even one glass of wine. What they're not realizing is that as that alcohol is metabolized in their body, it changes that sleep architecture that we were talking about earlier. And they are not getting that deep restorative sleep in the way that their brain is supposed to be getting it. And that's why during the day they don't feel so great.
Oh, that's all good information. Facebook comment from Evelyn says, do doctors still say that you can't catch up on lost sleep? It seems to work for me. And Sigrid, you were just saying you were in China and then you were, crossing all these various time zones. Can we make up for lost sleep?
I think you can catch up to a certain point. I think that if you have one night that's an all-nighter or a couple of nights during the week, you can certainly sleep in on a weekend and you will feel better. But one of the most important studies that's been done looking at chronic short sleep times is quite interesting. If you shorten your sleep to 5 hours a night across the week, catch up on three different nights of full recovery. So that would be a long weekend, right? That would be a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday night of getting all that sleep. After the first night, you can feel wonderful. But again, I mentioned this sustained vigilance, the ability to pay attention and stay on task. And it's quite remarkable that from three different universities, when studies have been done, people fail at that test. Huh. And it does not get better on the first night. It doesn't get better on the second night. And it doesn't get better on the third night. They're still abnormal. Some people respond better than others. But we have to keep in mind that your subjective measure, how you feel about sleepiness, may not be so accurate as far as the objective measures. And that always comes into play, again, when you're doing something dangerous like driving, etc.
Let me read a Facebook comment from Sophie, then we'll get our third guest to join us. She says, if I go to bed later, I often wake up earlier. If I go to sleep earlier, I mostly seem to sleep better. I mostly seem to sleep better through to my alarm. Is it my imagination? Some scientific basis for why this happens? The same seems to apply to my toddler. The idea, I mean, we don't always get those 7 or 8 hours. I mean, it seems there's life, right? There are toddlers who will wake us up.
Yeah, so really, we're creatures of habit, and that's why pick a bedtime, pick a wake-up time. Those are the habits we say to go back to, and we call that having good sleep hygiene, and that's always the anchors to stick to. So certainly disrupting that, going to bed a little bit later, kind of throws off your rhythm, if you will, and can then throw off the later rhythm. And so it's I'm not surprised to hear that, although you would think if you could have if you go to bed later, you could sleep a little bit later. But we often hear that from patients, that once you disrupt the initial part of the rhythm, the later one gets messed up.
And how much leeway do you – let's say you have to get up at 6, you should go to bed at 10, 10:30? How much can you play
with
that?
You really want to try to get at least 7 is the number.
Okay.
But you also have to know yourself. And so it's really – we say 7 and up is the number. We used to say 8 for everybody, and then after some – additional studies and looking at the data, it really is 8 plus or minus 1 or 2. So again, you have to know yourself and how you feel with that sustained attention. Some people may need 9, even adults. That's not only kids. There's definitely people who need 8.5 or 9.
Interesting.
And you have to know yourself.
And some people can only get 6 or 7 hours. And if you take a 6 and 7 hour person and put them in bed for 9 hours, they will surely have insomnia.
That's right.
Right? They're going to have a lot of
wake
time.
Because they don't want it. They don't need it. For whatever reason.
Right. So again, as Eileen says, you really just have to figure out what would you need if you're on vacation and you could just chill.
And that's the benchmark, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're on vacation, how do you sleep?
Yes.
And that tells you something about the rest of your life. And that's Sigrid Vesey and Eileen Rosen. They are both professors of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, both experts when it comes to sleep and sleep disorders and what we need to do to get a good night's sleep. We want to focus on something now called the sleep gap. In fact, it looks like racial minorities get less sleep than they should, including less sleep than whites, and that, of course, is bad for their health. Joining us is Lauren Hale, and she's a professor of family, population, and preventative medicine at Stony Brook University in the program of public health. She studies sleep and health disparities. She's also editor-in-chief of the journal Sleep Health. Lauren Hale, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Help us understand, what is this sleep gap about?
Sure. The sleep gap was first identified about 10 or 12 years ago when data from both self-reported and objectively assessed measures of sleep show that compared to whites, African Americans report less sleep. I heard earlier in this program you mentioned that about a third of adults are not getting the sleep they need, the 7 and up number. But when you look at African Americans, it's closer to 50% of African Americans are not getting the sleep they need. Even when you compare similarly situated socioeconomic status. So,
The question is why? Why?
That is
disparity?
A good question. I just want to point out one more thing, that it's not just duration. We find that African Americans report taking longer to fall asleep. They have poorer sleep quality with more fragmentation and less deep sleep. Mm-hmm. So there's differences in both duration and quality here.
Now, is it stress related? Is it just kind of how you live your life related? What do you think the reasons are?
Right. There's a lot of work going on to try and figure this out. In fact, the National Institute of Health has a call for proposals specifically trying to understand the mechanisms behind disparities in sleep, because They are aware of the consequences this has for health disparities and disparities more broadly. So, what are some of the hypotheses? Mm-hmm. I think of some of them as neighborhood and structural. For example, African Americans are more likely to live in urban areas, which are known to be noisier, have more light, which has been mentioned as very alerting, and urban environments are also more densely populated. We also imagine that work schedules play a role. We know that work schedules play a role in determining sleep. So if you think about a single mother who has to work two jobs to stay afloat financially, she needs to work and she wants to be there for her kids. So what's going to give?
Right.
Sleep. You tell me.
Yeah, sleep. No. Sleep. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. But then there's, I think, the final and perhaps most challenging struggle is the psychological factors that may be underlying disparities in sleep, not just black-white disparities, but one of the key themes of my research and others is that autonomy is really important for sleep. So people need to have control over their lives, and that includes control over their sleeping conditions. And if you are concerned about a threat, whether it's financial security or physical safety, your brain will limit your ability to fall asleep. And in the case of African Americans, we know that blacks unfortunately experience pervasive racism and discrimination, and this can cause heightened daytime stress levels and reduce the ability to get high quality sleep.
Lauren, let me get our other two guests to weigh in because they are nodding as you speak. Sigrid, mm-hmm. What do you say in terms of what Lauren is finding from her research?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And we can also say that from patients in the clinic, patients go to sleep who live in the city and in Philadelphia. Patients go to sleep with the television up really loudly so that they don't have to hear the fight across the hallway in the room. So there are some extreme circumstances for some individuals that certainly are playing a role. But I think that this issue that there might actually be differences in sleep architecture, there are differences in how deeply you can get into slow wave sleep. There are even differences in children where the nap time is, daytime nap period is extended in African American children to age 5, 6 and a little bit older. And so there are differences even in children that really are something that we need to take a better look at. And as Lauren's saying, this really can have a huge play on overall health. So the fact that average African American males in inner cities might only be sleeping 5 to 6 hours a night can certainly have an enormous role with obesity and many other metabolic conditions.
Well, I'm thinking too, Eileen Rosen, about kids and their preparedness going to school, for instance.
Yeah.
We were talking
yeah.
about if you don't get a good night's sleep, mm-hmm. it's hard to function at 100% or even at 90%.
Oh, definitely. And it makes you wonder how that will affect their performance during the day or their ability to pay attention and behaviors in school. Also thinking about just the sleeping environment, many of our patients will tell us, I can't really make my bedroom this soft, comfy, inviting place because there's 5 people in my bed with me. And that just thinking about, and it's from little kids to old grandparents in the same bed. So that sleep environment is something that maybe many of us take for granted, that African Americans, particularly in the inner cities, may have an issue with. The one thing I'm not sure if it's been looked at, Lauren, or if you can comment about, is that we know that patients with insomnia, you were speaking about arousal, patients with insomnia, when you do brain scans, PET scans, where it looks at the activity in the brain, those individuals have hyper-aroused brains, both not just during the day, but actually at night when the rest of us, our brains are quieting down. When you get back to what Sigrid was talking about at the very beginning, how all those neurons and centers shut off, patients who have insomnia don't get the same low level of activity. And it would be interesting to know if in African Americans that's been done to show if there's a change in the activity level or if they remain hyper aroused, and that's why their sleep quality is so different.
Yeah, Lauren, is there an answer to that?
Right. I don't have a specific study to point to about that, but it sounds like a great idea for a proposal.
Yes.
And I think this fits in with the hypothesis that there's vigilance from daytime and evening surroundings mm-hmm. may be contributing to the impaired quality of sleep. So that's a great hypothesis to test.
Is this more, Lauren, an urban problem, or is it also true in you know, the sort of quieter rural parts of America?
We see this using national data, not just in urban areas. So even in, we would say, non-urban, which would include suburban and rural, we do see black-white differences in sleep. But about one-third of the association is accounted for by the higher demographic distribution of blacks in urban environments. So we know that the urban explanation is not enough of the story, but it's a part of the story, and it's not easy to fix. There are a lot of factors going on.
Well, and we're almost up. We have to say goodbye to you, Lauren, in about 30 seconds. But sure. If this is a public health crisis, which it sounds like it is there a public health response?
Geesh.
Sorry about that. Unfair.
I think anything, this is a social problem and it requires social solutions. So opportunities to improve quality of life, control over life for all people, whether it's higher minimum wage, higher quality child care, better health care, later school start times, structural policies that allow people to turn off and rest at night, and get the sleep that they need in order to function optimally for their day is the right strategy.
Well, Lauren Hale, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Time. Such an important issue. Thanks so much.
You got it. Thanks.
You're welcome. Lauren Hale, Professor of Family, Population, and Preventative Medicine at Stony Brook University. Eileen Rosen, Sigrid Vesey, staying with us for the rest of the hour. Much more to talk about when it comes to sleep. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Let me get some more comments, and we got people that want to join our conversation. We have Will calling us from Fishtown, and Will, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, sorry. Hi.
Hi there.
I just am someone who has sometimes the early morning schedule, you know, working at 5 a.m., and then sometimes the late night schedule, you know, working till like 3 a.m., and it's pretty consistent. Didn't know if that affects anything, or if as long as you can get 8 hours, it doesn't matter.
Well, Sigrid Vesey just kind of grimaced when you asked that, Will. Let me see what she says.
I think, you know, you're to be admired for getting those, trying to get those 8 hours. It's very hard to do. One of the big challenges is that when you have those super early mornings but also have some late nights, you will be disrupting the circadian rhythm. If you can imagine, it's almost as if you're flying to Paris one night, back in New York the next, flying to Paris the next, back in New York the next. And that disruption of the circadian rhythm is probably okay on the short term, and you probably will just feel a little off. But in the long term, what we're finding out is that disrupting the circadian rhythm does have profound effects on the whole metabolic system, the cardiovascular system, may even have an influence on cancers. In fact, there are long-term circadian disruption of shift workers is associated with increased risk for certain cancers. And then there's the risk now that may Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative processes may also come into play. So sounds scary.
It
if you're
does.
Doing it short term and it's only for a year or two, it's probably not going to have a major impact. But we don't know that for sure. And we really have a big problem because we live in a 24-hour society and haven't really figured out how to address this issue.
So stay tuned. But Will, hold on. Eileen wants to add something to that.
And Will, I'm not sure that you have much control over this, but one thing that we can do as a field is that we have not been educating the supervisors who make these schedules. And so there is a little bit known about the science about how to do rotating shifts, and they should be forward rotated so that you should do a morning shift for a while, and then a midday shift, and then an evening shift, and then an overnight shift with some standard breaks in between. And in medicine, we haven't done this very well, quite frankly. With nursing, there was a lot of educating we had to do, and we're still struggling with it. So we do need to get the word out there about how to do this and not have you bouncing back and forth, going to Paris and New York the way Sigrid is describing, because essentially there we can help a little bit with that.
Kind of Paris in your mind, right?
Yes.
Because
exactly.
You're
not actually going there. really Paris.
No,
right.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, it's work.
It's work. Will, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me read a couple of more questions. One from Mary. She says, I get headaches when I sleep 7 or 8 hours, but I feel fine with 5 or 6. Is that okay? Are some people who just function better on less sleep? And maybe, Eileen, I'm back to you.
So I think that this gets at what you were asking in the very beginning about the sort of hangover effect. So if you get 7 or 8 hours in one night and have a headache, what I would say is do that several nights in a row and really make sure that the headaches are sustained, because it might be that you are getting in that 7 or 8 hour night a lot of the deeper stages of sleep, which are what is associated with the sort of hangover headache effect. Also, having headaches in the morning with deeper sleep, if it is on sustained nights, could be a sign of another sleep disorder. Like sleep apnea can be associated with morning headaches. And so if there's any snoring, morning headaches, dry mouth, you're waking up during the night to go to the bathroom, and other things to go along with those morning headaches with sustained extended sleep periods, that should be checked out by a physician.
What about sleep and aging? And I ask, that is an aging. Yeah. We are all aging, but how does sleep change? And it seems like it does.
Sleep changes in many different ways. Of course, everyone knows that you don't sleep as well as that little toddler, that wonderful little toddler that you can carry in from the car, change a diaper, and they never wake up. That's the best sleep that you'll ever have as a toddler. But it's sort of all downhill.
Damn it.
It's all downhill from there. But there are several important relationships. One is that females tend to complain more about insomnia when they're older, but the reassuring fact is that their sleep is actually deeper slow-wave sleep, and it's a healthier slow-wave sleep, and they sleep a little bit longer. And so the sleep in females is perceived to be poor, but it actually may be better than it really seems to be. So that's the reassuring fact. Sleep will just become lighter, and will have less, ultimately have less of this difference of this wonderful circadian rhythm where you're super alert in the daytime and super sleepy in the nighttime. They sort of melt together. And so it's not uncommon to have problems. The more active you are in the daytime, the more likely you are to sleep well at night. That's a critical part for when people get older. Business of sitting in front of a television and zoning out for an hour or two is just enough to start to tap into that homeostatic drive to sleep, that there may be less drive to sleep in the nighttime.
So be as active as you can be during the day, and that will hopefully help you sleep at night. What about naps? And I've done enough shows about sleep. Shows where naps were good, then they were bad, then they were good, then they were short-term and power naps and all that. Where are we, Eileen, when it comes to naps and napping?
Well, what I would say is the best countermeasure for sleep is sleep. So if you're someone who is, by nature of your work or nature of your schedule, getting less sleep, getting a nap is not a bad thing, as long as they're done strategically and they're not interfering with your ability to go to sleep at night. And so there are circadian opportunities for naps. So during the daytime, the circadian opportunity for that would be in the afternoon, the siesta period.
Yes.
The Europeans have it right. We are biologically programmed with our circadian clock to be more inclined to take a nap from 2 to 5 in the afternoon, depending on your internal clock. And a short nap, a short power nap of 30 minutes or so, is enough to make you feel more alert for about 2 hours. And then if you're working overnight and have the opportunity to take a break, mm-hmm. you might also want to take a short nap. I mean, long distance pilots get an opportunity to do that in the cockpit. They take turns. They use caffeine before a nap like that so that they don't have that inertia afterwards. There are strategic ways to take a nap. Certainly a longer nap will make you feel more refreshed for longer. But if you take a 3-hour nap after work in the afternoon, if you get home at 4 o'clock till 7 p.m., yikes. You're not going to be able to go to bed at night, and then you're going to have this perpetuating cycle. So you need to be smart about it.
Let me see what Gregory from Cherry Hill has to say. And Gregory, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Yes, go ahead, Gregory.
Hi. I want to mention that ever since my youth, I always had trouble falling asleep. And it was very problematic when I was in high school because my schedule was so off. I woke up, 6 a.m. 5 days a week and then slept in on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And it became especially problematic when I found out that I had epilepsy, because lack of sleep was a major trigger for seizures.
Well, you raised such an several interesting points, Gregory. One having to do with teenagers, and of course, how we know how you were saying earlier, Sigrid, that teenagers need 9 hours, and school starts at 7:15 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. And Gregory's bringing up probably one of the scariest aspects of sleep deprivation. That it can actually lower the threshold for seizures. That absolutely. Of all the different people who need to sleep, those who are driving long distances and those with epilepsy really need to make sure they're getting enough sleep. For the adolescents, for the teenagers, there are several moves across the country to delay the school times, and it does have some effect. There are positive effects with getting just that one extra hour of sleep, and a lot of it is they're still going to bed close to the same time, but they're waking up at a later time. It really does seem to be effective. And that's something that people all across the country should really push for in their communities, because it probably would help an awful lot of teenagers.
Let's talk a bit about technologies. I mean, we talked about the screens that are keeping us up, but what about there are ways you can monitor your sleep? Are you a fan of that, Eileen?
So we'll say is that consumer technologies are on the rise to look at your sleep. I think everyone from Apple to Fitbit have realized that we can hack our sleep to a point. I think what's out there now is that we can make sure that we are regularly getting into bed at the same time and getting up at a certain time, and that those are the hours that we were in bed. This idea that right now all of these devices tell you, I have patients say, I didn't get much restful sleep, even though I thought I slept 8 hours every night for the last week. It's not clear how accurate those things are. Huh. So again, if you are using it to monitor how much sleep you get, I think that's wonderful. If you wake up and have sustained attention and you can drive and pay attention at work and be at a boring meeting or lecture, then you're doing fine. There's actually a disorder now about obsessing over your sleep technology. It's called orthosomnia. And so do not worry if you feel great and your device says you're not getting good sleep. But if you don't feel great, your device is a great way for you to interact with your physician to show these are some things we can try to work on together. And so there is a time and a place for it, but it's not the be-all and end-all with the devices that are out there now. Do I think it's coming? Yes. Artificial intelligence and big data. Soon we'll be able to use that data in different ways than we have now. But right now, we're not entirely there.
So again, I'm thinking about that person who tosses and turns. Let's say they're up at 2:30. First of all, they look at the clock. That may be the first bad thing that they're doing.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
But do you stay in bed and toss and turn? Do you get up and clean the dryer out? I mean, what do you do?
It sounds awful when we're coming up to the winter months when it's cold outside that bed, right? So that makes a big problem. But you want that bed, again, just to be the place where you're sure is going to be wonderful, luscious sleep. And so if you're waking up repeatedly, sort of awake for an hour, and you find yourself getting revved up, so it's sort of, I really have to fall back to sleep. Now it's 2:25. Now it's 2:30. I really have to fall back to sleep. If you're in that mode, you really do need to get up, get out of the bedroom, go read a book in a separate room if you have the luxury of having a separate room, and then come back to bed when you really feel like you're ready to fall off to sleep. It's really the whole situation of Pavlov's bell. It's really associating the bed with wonderful sleep. When you open up that bedroom door, you want to say, the bed, I can't wait to get into that. And you never want to open up the bedroom door and say, this better be a good night because I really need my sleep.
Right, I've got a big meeting tomorrow.
You've just built up your adrenaline and you won't be able to sleep.
Let me get Gary from Bridgeport to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
You spoke about how alcohol affects sleep, but as marijuana laws are changing, more people will start using that, and I'm wondering how that affects sleep.
That's a good question. Yep. I'm back to you, Sigrid, it looks like.
So marijuana does have effects on sleep, and I think we're still at a stage that I'm not sure if we understand specifically for which of the different chemicals has which of the various effects on sleep. The THC certainly can improve slow-wave sleep. We don't really have a good handle on the duration and how well that helps with the continuity of sleep and whether you're able to get into some of of the other phases of sleep may help more with sleep onset issues. Eileen, I don't know if you want to comment on that. We're early in the process, so it just makes it we don't really understand enough about how well it helps most people.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree with that. And we think it might make sleep apnea worse, where mm-hmm. The jury is kind of out on that. And so we can't really say.
Here's an email from Nancy. She says, my son and daughter, who are both adults, both use sleep machines. My daughter puts on a sleep machine or a white noise machine for her one-year-old. How does that affect sleep? I guess I'm looking at you, Eileen.
Yeah.
You two are looking at each other, I should say.
So these are ways to get rid of distracting noises in the bedroom. So for someone who says to me, I have the TV on because I need a distracting noise to help me fall asleep, or I can hear the neighbors fighting across the way or noise outside, white noise is a great way to put that in the background and not be worried that there's a light on from the TV or that the volume will change during the night, and you can set a timer on these things. And so that's perfectly reasonable for someone who thinks they need that. I would say with a child or a toddler, if you can keep the house or the room relatively quiet or get them used to a low level of noise, not to use them as a matter of a course. But once someone is using them, they're probably fine.
Yeah. How about having the radio on all night?
The radio is probably a little bit better than the television, but it still has the same problem that the advertisements for many stations are up another decibel or two. And so that really does tend to wake people up. I think this business of being able to get used to, oh, I'm awake, and in a relaxed fashion just fall back to sleep is a wonderful thing. That's great for babies, and it's great for adults as well. So it's a skill. It's a learned behavior to really know that you can be awake and you can drift off just to sleep by yourself. But it's really something to work on, and probably a better alternative because of the noise variability with radios.
And I'm assuming you both are champion sleepers?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm a pretty good sleeper.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Oh, good. Good. Well, I appreciate you joining us, coming into our studio and talking about sleep, such an important thing. Sigurd Vesey, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. A great time to be here.
Yes, indeed. Eileen Rosen, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And they're both professors of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine.